This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
When the largest protest since Fidel Castro's revolution swept Cuba, the Cuban government quickly struck back, carrying out mass arrests. Some protesters were forcibly detained as they chanted Patria y Vida, or Homeland and Life, the song that has become the anthem of frustration with the communist state. One of those arrested was photographer Anielo Troya, who filmed part of the music video for Patria y Vida in Havana. Less than 2 weeks after the protests, Troya was tried, convicted, and sentenced to a year in prison. His mother says he told the court he did nothing wrong.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The audio you just heard was from CNN talking about the protests in Cuba, and we started hearing about that last week. What is going on with it right now? Is this the start of a freedom movement, which would unlock liberty for the residents of that island for the first time in many, many decades? Here to talk to us about that is Dr. Gracie Christie. She's a policy advisor for the Catholic Association, which you can find online at thecatholicassociation.org. She practices radiology in the Miami area, where she lives with her husband and five children. She grew up in Guadalajara, Mexico, coming to the United States at the age of 11. She's a graduate of Columbia University and the University of Miami School of Medicine. She's also of Cuban descent and is keeping her eye on what's happening 90 miles off of Florida's coast. And Dr. Gracie Christie, welcome back to the show. Great to talk to you again.
Thank you, Ed. It's wonderful to hear your voice.
Ed, same here. And always we have such interesting topics to discuss. And this is, I think, one of the more intriguing things that have happened in Cuba since the death of Fidel Castro. I think that, this is an opening that you don't normally see in these types of very repressive dictatorships. And that's really what's happening in Cuba. This is, it's communist, but communism is really just a mechanism for dictatorship. And the people there are one of the infrequent responses to that last week, but it's quieted down. And is that a worrisome sign?
Well, it's a very natural thing to happen because the Cuban government has responded with brutal repression. They've heavily militarized the streets. They've apprehended or disappeared, as we say, hundreds of people. They are going door to door, checking people's phones for hashtags, for images, for signs that they have shared the protest amongst themselves in the island and also outside of the island. I mean, they have the kind of repressive police state that Americans can't really imagine. And that's, I think, one of the problems with the way that the United States relates to Cuba, is that it's hard for us to imagine the misery of the lives that they live.
And it's interesting because I think that in this case, I mean, certainly we've had reason to criticize media coverage when it comes to Cuba, when it comes to human rights there. But in this case, I think the media is doing a fairly decent job of this. New York Times yesterday had a very good article on this, and the headline is "Terror: Crackdown After Protests in Cuba Sends a Chilling Message." And look, I mean, I think that the dictatorship may have been caught off guard about these protests at first, Gracie, but they're not off guard now, and they put together impressive in a very, obviously in a very bad way, plan to terrorize their subjects until they quiet down and stop making trouble for them. And if you read through the New York Times article, it's it talks about the courage of the many Cubans when they poured into the streets, and saying that, down with the dictatorship, we are not afraid. They're afraid now, and for very good reason.
I shared a video today on my Twitter feed of a man putting up a cross on a street corner, a big, tall cross, and it says on it, Patria y Vida, which means homeland and life, which is the the motto of this of the demonstrators, and it says, "God, please, homeland and life." It's very affecting because, you know, for that man to take, he takes his life into his hands when he goes and he puts up that cross. There are people videotaping him. There are people, you know, the police, the kind of police state that is normal in Cuba is one which rivals that of East Germany as far as the amount of vigilance that is done by the government on the people and the amount of, you know, sort of micro control over the people's acts and thoughts and everything about their lives.
So let's go back to the beginning of this. I mean, the beginning of this particular round of protests. I mean, we know what the beginning of this is. The beginning is that the Cuban people have been trapped in this tyranny for 60 years. What spurred on this particular episode of protest and dissent in the streets? Because clearly there something reached a critical mass which moved everybody out into the street trying to change the way things were going in Cuba.
I think it's because the people have truly reached rock bottom, and they feel that. They are feeling that all across the island. There has been a huge drop in the amount of food in the stores. There has been terrible illness due to COVID, and there is no medicine. There are no oxygen tanks. There's no antibiotics in the hospitals. The hospitals don't have necessarily water or electricity. So they've seen themselves, you know, they know that they live on a slave island and that things are only getting worse. Some of the signs I've seen people carrying in the images that have been projected from Cuba are signs that say, "We are willing to risk our lives because we don't have any lives, and that we really have no lives. So why not risk them?" And I do feel that's the feeling, the general feeling in Cuba.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's a measure of how desperate things have become there. And you know, there's certainly a great deal of debate here about that. Now, I would say that the response from the U.S. has been fairly bipartisan and fairly good. I know that the Biden administration has talked about imposing fresh sanctions, maybe as early as today. We are expecting to hear from the White House that there will be fresh sanctions over how Cuba is responding to these protests. And, of course, Havana was hoping that the change in administration would bring back the sort of detente that took place in the Obama administration, that Joe Biden would move in that direction. And I think Joe Biden wanted to do that, but after this, it does appear that things are going to be, there's going to be tougher reaction here from the United States. But there were voices that were claiming that really the U.S. Sanctions are what's creating the desperation for the people in Cuba. And, I mean, I think that that's a bit of a dead-end argument, but I'm curious as to your reaction to that.
Well, when I hear people here in the United States, politicians like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, when she says that, she's simply repeating the talking points of the regime, exactly their talking points. Because, you know, in Cuba, that's one of the ways that's one of the ideologies that they enforce from day one, that there's this evil empire 90 miles off their shores keeping them in poverty and hurting them. But the truth is that the embargo... first of all, the embargo only applies to the United States. The rest of the world is eager to participate with Cuba in all sorts of ways. And also, the embargo has never had any effect on food sources or medicines. So the embargo doesn't really hurt the Cuban people in the way that the Cubans profess. There's also an internal blockade that the Cuban government enforces on the people, and that's what's really keeping them immiserated. So, for instance, in Cuba yesterday, in Havana, I saw reports that the Cuban government is selling lobster to the Cuban people. And I asked a Cuban friend of mine, I said, "Why is it a big deal that they can buy lobster?" And he said, "Well, in Cuba, we're not allowed to eat lobster. Even though the water around us is teeming with lobster, lobster is only for the tourists. So if you're caught catching and eating a lobster, you could end up in jail." So Cuban people for decades have never eaten lobster.
Wow. I mean, that's sort of amazing. That's the type of thing that you think, because it's plentiful, it would make some sense just from a public relations standpoint for the regime to provide at least some of that to their own people. And again, we're talking with Dr. Gracie Christie. We're taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And I think that there was probably some of that that was... Some of those types of restrictions were probably amplified in the few years in which there was some travel that was taking place between Cuba and the United States. I mean, this was in the sort of the defrosting cycle, I guess we can call it, with the Obama administration, when they were trying to reduce or eliminate large parts of the embargo. And we started seeing some tourist travel back and forth. And I remember people were warning, if you're going to do that, the Cuba that you're going to see is only the Cuba that the power structure in Havana wants you to see. And it will be very structured. And a lot of people came back and said, yes, it's very structured. We really didn't see, we were able to go out and see things for ourselves. And so a lot of that commerce that was supposed to alleviate the type of thing that critics of the embargo now are saying is caused by the embargo, that didn't even really touch the lives of most of the people who are having to live under this regime.
You know, when tourists go to Cuba, they are served by Cuban slaves, and they enjoy the natural habitat, the natural beauties of Cuba in ways that the people of Cuba are not allowed to enjoy. So people in Cuba don't go to the beach. The beaches are reserved for tourists. So to go to Cuba as a tourist is apartheid tourism. I mean, you're going there to live. You're going to a slave plantation and staying at the big house, but that's not proper. It's immoral. It was very bad of President Obama to reinstitute that. And you know, when Cuba lost the support of Russia and Venezuela, later on Venezuela, what happened was that they had to depend on tourism. I mean the regime, because none of this money, none of it goes down to the Cuban people. They get slave wages, and if they want to take advantage of tourism, they can do that as prostitutes on the beach, which is a very, you know, sex tourism is a big deal in Cuba.
Right.
So tourism was a big was their big regime support. That's how they made the money that they lost from Venezuela and Russia. And another way that they made money is that they send out forced labor. More than 30,000 Cubans are sent out to work in what they call missions, but are really forced labor situations, in 58 different countries. And most of them are medical professionals. And this actually grew significantly under COVID. So when people were, you know, getting COVID in Cuba and going to the hospital, they didn't have anyone to take care of them because their doctors were being sent out to make $6 to $8 billion for the Cuban regime a year.
I mean, this is the type of exploitation that has been going on continuously under the Castro regime, and this is still the Castro regime. I mean, make no mistake about this. This is still a Castro dictatorship that the island is operating under. And I think the events of the past week prove this, right? I mean, and again, we're talking with Dr. Gracie Christie, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. One of the things that I think that we were looking at is what happens post-Castro, right? What happens post-Fidel, mostly? Because I don't think people thought that Raul was going to be quite as sustainable as he proved to be. But what happens after Fidel? And the whole idea behind the relaxing of the embargo, if you will, in the Obama administration was, well, we're preparing to work with the moderates. We're preparing to work with the moderates. Because after the Castros are gone, people in this regime know it's dead end, and they're going to be looking for a deal. I think what happened this past week, and what the New York Times actually did a very good job of reporting, I believe this was on Wednesday when this article appeared, is that we're not dealing with moderates here. There are no moderates mm-hmm. in this regime. This is still a radical dictatorship that is willing to brutally impose its will on a subjugated people. And that is, I think, the big lesson that American policymakers have to learn from this, right?
You know, and maybe they're eliminating the moderates. They're, in the last week, five or six, depending on which source you read, Cuban generals have suddenly died. without any explanation of their cause of death, and they were quickly cremated without any state honors, as is normal. And people in Cuba are wondering, well, were these guys, you know, considered a danger? Were these the moderates that might have, right. you know, like risen up against the regime? Possibly, but they're dead.
Which tells you another thing about what's going to happen in the end here. I mean, this is not. I mean, there have been. I guess you can point to a couple of transitions in Eastern Europe where you've had an orderly shift in power from dictatorships or oligarchies to somewhat popular democratic models of government. Most of the time, though, when you have this type of dictatorship, this type of regime in charge, the end game of this is almost always violent. It's almost always a bloodbath in the streets. And it's also almost always going to create almost as radical a response as the radical nature of the regime itself. I mean, that's really one of the big issues that American policymakers really do have to be concerned about as this regime nears its end, which hopefully is going to be soon.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it could very much go south. It could be worse, but it's hard to imagine anything worse.
Well, not worse in terms. I don't want to say worse because I agree with you. I don't know that you could get worse than what the Cuban people are going through and have been going through for decades. I think that what the concern is going to be, though, is it will be worse in the very short term. Right? It'll be very bloody. Mm-hmm. And then in the end, what you're going to wind up with is something that's probably almost, if not just as bad, but just in a completely different sort of paradigm. It's not going to be communist. It's going to be strongman. It's going to be warlord type of things where you have multiple competing centers of power. And those are the types of things that do often happen when you have a collapse of a very powerful central government, central government dictatorship, that type of thing. And I think those are certainly the concerns that people are going to be worried about.
I feel, Ed, that the people are almost longing for that in Cuba. Like they're the person who's been hanging on for so long that they're willing to take any risk and endure any suffering for a change, even if the end result might be not what they hope for. I mean, they're really in an untenable situation.
Yes, I agree. Let's talk a little bit about religious expression. You know, we often hear that the Cuban government has sort of relented on religious expression a bit, that they're allowing more of this. During the Obama administration, the Vatican did try to help negotiate that situation in large part in hopes that it would improve the lives of Cuban Catholics. I think a very honorable and worthwhile motive. I'm not necessarily sure that it succeeded, and that doesn't detract from the goodwill that was part of that effort. But you mentioned somebody putting up a cross, and that is still considered apparently a political crime there. Has that situation improved over the last few years?
They've improved the window dressing around it. But speaking to people of faith, not always Catholic, I spoke to a Cuban priest yesterday, for instance, and I have friends who are very fervent Christians who participate in house church movements in Cuba. The sense that I get is that the window dressing around it seems like it's more open and more accepting, but all the religious activities are heavily infiltrated by government agents.
Yeah.
And they're there. They're sitting in the pew next to you. They're in the church, in the house church meeting, and they're in the same room with you. So there's a lot of distrust. And, you know, it's a very sad thing that when you go to worship, to think always, who is listening? What am I going to say? Am I going to put my foot in the wrong place? And that causes, that poisons religion. It poisons the faith of the people. That's how the regime plans it. They want you to feel scared and ill at ease, even though the church doors are open and you can walk in. They don't want you to feel comfortable there.
Well, I think, in especially this is true in communist regimes, I think, or Marxist mm-hmm. regimes. One of the central conceits of communism or Marxism is that the system itself can perfect man. right? I mean, this was very true under the Soviets. You know, the whole line of thinking about the new Soviet man sort of thing. If you know the history of the Soviet Union and how they marketed Marxism, the idea was that you didn't need religion. In fact, religion was a hindrance because it meant that there was the idea that a divine creator would automatically negate the idea that a political / economic system could perfect man and undo all the different flaws in human nature. And so there is an already contentious relationship between dictatorships and churches, because they're talking about very different powers of authority. And I think that's even more so in communist-based dictatorships. And so it's not really sustainable. I mean, I get the idea, and I get the motivation behind trying to open things up in Cuba as a way to help out people of faith. But really what we're talking about are systems that are completely incompatible. And especially where you have, strongman, cult leader type of dictatorships under communism in this particular case, as the Castros are. I mean, it's just simply they can't coexist. Those two systems cannot coexist.
There's a deep longing in the Cuban people, though, for faith. I here in Miami, where I live, there's a shrine to Our Lady of Charity, who's the patroness of Cuba, and I go every week. And it's full of Cubans who have recently arrived, and they come to Our Lady, and they come with their arms full of flowers, and they bring their children to present her to Our Lady, and they are completely unformed as Catholics. They you can tell nobody has ever taught them to cross themselves. That they're very they're like children, even though they're grown up, they're like children in church, right. And it's a beautiful thing to see. It affects me so much when I see the faith with which they approach Our Lady, with all that love and pent up longing and hope. It's really beautiful. So all that is there. It'd be wonderful if they could recapture religion and not just that longing.
And also not recapture freedom, because I mean there were problems under the Batista regime. Cuba's been a very difficult place for a very long time. What we want to see is some sort of transformation that really lifts up and frees the Cuban people once and for all. And I think that's really Dr. Gracy Christie, I think that's really what we're praying for at this point.
I agree, Ed. It would be a lovely miracle if we could see that in our lifetimes.
It would indeed. Dr. Gracy Christie is the policy advisor for the Catholic Association. That's thecatholicassociation.org. And she's always a great guest here. And I want to thank Gracy for being with us. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Mario Enzler about the implications of the end of the eviction moratorium. It's being debated in Congress today. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Fact-driven, faith-informed, unfiltered. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
It's 29 minutes past the hour at MorrisseyOnAir.com. Filling in for Drew today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Right now, Congress is just starting to take up the issue of the eviction moratorium that's linked to the pandemic emergency response. This is a moratorium that was passed by Congress in their first major relief bill in April of 2020, and the CDC has been left to renew this. Now, just to give you a little background on this, the CDC doesn't actually have statutory authority to extend the time on this. However, the Supreme Court allowed the last extension to continue up until July 31st and ruled at that point the Congress would have to act if they wanted to extend it any further. July 31st, of course, being tomorrow, this is the Supreme Court had ruled on this last month, so they've had several weeks to do something about this. Unfortunately, they have just started to take it up today, and they're also in the middle of negotiating an infrastructure package. So there is a very strong likelihood that the moratorium will just come to a stop tomorrow, leaving about 12 million Americans under rent stress, I guess you could say, to potentially fend for themselves, and also leaving a lot of landlords, many of whom are small holding landlords, in a very difficult position, both financially and morally, and how to address what is clearly still going to be a crisis for some time to come. Here to discuss that is Dr. Mario Ensler. He's the Dean of the Cameron School of Business at the University of St. Thomas in Houston, in my newly adopted state of Texas. He's a former musician, a former Swiss guard, and former Swiss banker. He wanted to introduce authentic gelato in New England, but instead he and his wife founded a classical curriculum academy in New Hampshire after moving there and not finding adequate educational options for their five children. Excuse me. He's a speaker at conferences all over the world, where he shares about the role Pope St. John Paul II had in helping him become a better man, executive, and leader. He is the author of I Served a Saint. And Dr. Mario Ensler, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you very much. It's an honor and a pleasure always to be with you guys. I love Relevant Radio.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Well, I have to say, I love any man who tries to introduce authentic gelato to the United States. So...
Well, there is a lot of fake gelato around, trust me.
There is a lot of fake gelato around. When you go to Italy, you suddenly realize, oh, wait a minute,
yeah,
this
all
is
of
gelato.
A sudden, whoa, what I've been buying is authentic gelato, it's not this.
So now you've heard this, folks. You need to either need to talk to Dr. Ensler, or you need to go visit Italy and find out what
Amen.
Gelato is actually about. There you go. So... I mean, this is a real conundrum, because it's very easy for us to fall into ideological paradigms when
Absolutely.
It comes to dealing with the issue of rent actions, evictions, non-payment, and dealing with emergencies. I have to tell you, I just moved to Texas over the last few weeks, and
okay.
I can't imagine having to do a move, even one that I'm, willing to do and preparing for, in the middle of a pandemic, right? I mean, because you interact with so many different people, and if you're not vaccinated and if there aren't those protections, it really does present a lot of potential for the spread of the virus. And so
Correct.
The moratorium that Congress passed last year made some sense, even though it is potentially very damaging to the whole economy of renting and landlording, I guess, for a better, lack of a better term.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's just one of those things that you have to do during a pandemic. However, at some point, of course, this is going to come to an end. And like I said, when I'm introducing this topic, there's a whole lot of people out there, and not just the 12 million or so people who are renting, who are behind on rent and facing real significant issues in terms of employment, in terms of cash flow and that sort of thing, but also the landlords, because I've seen numbers that range between 40% to 50% of landlords are actually small holding landlords. They're not corporations. They're people who
Correct.
Own one or two houses, and
Correct.
Non-payment could very well cost them their own house in the end. It could ruin them, and so we are left in a very difficult position, Dr. Ensler.
I totally agree with everything you just said. Especially it's affecting what I call the residential landlords. As you just said, somebody that maybe they save some money, and instead of putting it into the stock market, they decided in an Italian way to buy the brick. Okay, so maybe
yes.
they bought a old house, they renovated in foreseeing that their 6 years old daughter, once married, will go and live there. Okay, but in
right.
the meantime, they decided to make an income out of it. All right, and so they open up to rent, and then the pandemic came, and they are struggling right now because they have their costs. They have their mortgage that they have to pay. So it was a very chaotic situation. But, I dare to say today that this rent moratoria, both theologically and practically, okay, was necessary, because let's say it the right way. You cannot get blood out of a turnip. That's the
right.
way I see it, okay? And there would have been even more chaos and even more riots if something like this would not have been put in place. But what I dare to say today is, you know, the Catholic Church, for instance, teaches that access to a safe, decent, and affordable housing is a human right as well as a demand of the common good. So in Texas, since you just arrived here, in Texas for the past 14 months, I have experienced on my own skin the authentic principle of subsidiarity. In other words, people started to talk. Transparency and accountability finally became meaningful to a lot of people. And right. Media deliberately decided to not emphasize or highlighting the successful stories of tenants and landlords becoming a force for unity, starting to talk and figuring out ways to make it work. Instead, they always decide to have this fear, you know, and now everybody has to be alarmed, and what's going to happen to these 12 million people? Well, here in Houston, for instance, at our university for the past 12 months, we've been educating a lot of the renters, okay, on how you have to save, what personal finance is, how you have to get out and find a way to make it work. Easy to say, very hard to do, but what an amazing opportunity we have throughout this crisis to authentically become not just lender and renter a force for unity, but us all together in a small town, in a huge city like Houston, which is called the UN cities in the United States. That's where I live, okay? We have the majority of diversity is in Houston. You know, 46 different languages spoken daily in Houston, okay? But people got together, and the principle of subsidiarity, you know, that was developed at the beginning in the famous encyclical Rerum Novarum, you know, by Pope Leo XIII, that was an attempt to, what I would say, articulate, you know, a course between the laissez-faire capitalism and on one hand, and the other forms of socialism on the other. And, okay, here in Texas, but all over the United States, really shaped. And I am so proud of the American citizens.
Well, you know, I think you're talking about both subsidiarity and solidarity here. And that Absolutely. Is always the balance that we as Catholics are looking for when we're discussing resolutions to vexing social issues. And, you know, this is it's a vexing social issue anyway. I mean, there's a chronic issue in terms of housing. There's a chronic issue in terms of, you know, lessee, lessor relationships. I mean, that's a chronic thing. And yes. that requires long-term policymaking. But in this case, we have a real crisis here. And I think that, first off, we just simply haven't prepared for this in terms of policymaking. I you know, talked a little bit about this. This is a deadline that we've known about for weeks. It's an issue that we knew was going to come to a head for months, right. And nobody's prepared for this. So that's one thing. That's a macro criticism. But
Correct.
When we're talking about being on the ground and talking about people who are trying to work together in order to survive, yes. You know, the small landlords and the renters who work with them. I mean, that is both subsidiarity and solidarity. And so we need to be able to craft policies that support that. And I think in the first place, we have to recognize, as you just did, Dr. Ensler, that those solutions exist and people are actually putting those solutions into place. And then we have to find ways to not just endorse that, but to encourage more of it.
Absolutely. I am with you. I feel that in crisis, if you go back 20 centuries, okay, you can see that it's throughout crisis that people united, okay? It's ironic, almost an oxymoron, but that's the truth, all right? I'll give you an example. On 2017, when Houston got on its knees because of Harvey, or simply 5 months ago, okay, when Houston got on its knees, the entire Texas, because of the extraordinary freeze that landed in Texas, okay? Well, the people were not prepared, right? But the people reacted. The people responded. And together, they helped. They came up and they share their knowledge, their wisdom. They share their baptismal commitments because they are conscious of having been incorporated into the church within its secular dimension. And so I saw people with financial strength helping people with zero financial strength. At the same time, I saw people with biological strength and helping people disabled, the most vulnerable. We are made in the image of God. We have an innate goodness, and that goodness emerges especially in crisis. That's why I always say we need policy, but those policy, they need to be locally at first, because it's through this community that we can then enlarge it and make it bigger.
And Dr. Insler, this is exactly my philosophy when we're dealing with policies of all kinds. I mean, there is a role for the national government for dealing with, especially in an emergency like this, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Simply put, you're not going to have the resources, the emergency resources, anywhere else except at the national level to deal with a crisis of this magnitude and of this breadth. But the proper way to deal with this is to allow for the action to take place at the most local level. And of course,
correct,
in the church, we say at the family level, but of course you have to engage,
correct,
as well with other families. So the most,
correct,
local level, and not only does that put the best use of the most efficient use of resources, but it also creates a diverse quilt, if you will, of,
yes,
of potential solutions and,
yes,
and opportunities to learn and opportunities to innovate in solutions that can be applied elsewhere or adapted elsewhere to the very, idiosyncratic conditions that might exist. You know, what works in Houston might work also in Des Moines, but it would have to maybe be adjusted a little bit for the local dimensions there. But
yes,
having that really gives you, having that ability to do this from the local up really gives you an ability to do that kind of innovation.
Of course, I teach my student that the best entrepreneurs are individuals that they lose their job or they are in the middle of a crisis. Why? Because they have to figure out what's next. They cannot just sit down and complain. They need to live their adulthood, okay, and they need to figure out a way to make it work. And community, relationship helps that, facilitates that. You said it right. I saw in the past 12, 13 months, the most innovative idea coming alive. Idea that right now we can say, duh, we could have done that, but we were comfortable. We lost, let's be realistic, we lost the meaning of the word thank you. For the past 25, 30 years, we don't even know what being grateful means. We did everything for granted, right? But it's through a crisis that we are, we got to do something here. And I agree with you. We start at the local level, at the community level, and then from there, whatever works the best, automatically, naturally, because of who we are, okay, because of the love that we have for our neighbors, we will expand it. Obviously, you always have, and this is society today, people that will try to take advantage of it, right? We know that. There is always the case. But
right,
I don't need people from somewhere else to tell us what to do in my street, in the cul-de-sac where I live, when we lose power. If one of us has a generator, we know that the other three don't have it, so let's figure out to share that generator so that we can all have heat, for instance.
Indeed, and we're speaking with Dr. Mario Ensler. We're talking about the rent crisis that is about to unload if Congress doesn't act. It will eventually need to be dealt with, regardless whether Congress acts now or manages to postpone this for a couple of months. This is a reckoning that is going to be due. And yep. The question is exactly how do we build the correct off-ramps for this crisis? How do we structure this in a way where people can be assured that all the equities in these equations are satisfied? Because otherwise, if you satisfy one at the expense of the other, you run the very real risk, and we'll talk about this with Dr. Ensler when we come back from the break, you run the very real risk of damaging or destroying the market that actually successfully houses people on a scale of tens of millions. And if you do that, you're going to wind up with a crisis that's actually much larger, much, much larger than the crisis that we're facing right now. Again, we're speaking with Dr. Mario Ensler. We're going to come back to this after the break. Take your phone calls at 888-914-9149 if you want to talk about housing or if you want to talk about gelato. We're going to take those calls too. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew, and we'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Your news, your issues, your opinion. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Hotair.com, filling in for Drew, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9. In the middle of a great conversation with Dr. Mario Ensler. He's the dean of the Cameron School of Business at the University of St. Thomas in Houston. He's a gelato expert. We're going to have to just get you back on, Dr. Ensler, to talk about that. I want to do a half hour just on that. It's awesome. But we are in the middle of a much more important conversation about where we go with the rent crisis here at the end of this pandemic emergency. Eventually, we are going to need an exit ramp here. And I think that if we're looking at our national policymakers, it doesn't look like they have a plan in place for that. I'm not talking about members of one party or another. I don't see any plans about this from anybody at the national level. I know that you're seeing good work being done at the local level in Houston, but I mean, what is it that we need to do? Because we really do have to protect all the equities here if we want to maintain a useful market for rental housing for tens of millions of Americans.
Well, you know, I dare to say that, you know, to me, Mario, this crisis, you know, that we are still in the midst of is unlikely. It's unlike any we have undergone, you know, before. Yeah. And though there are many unknowns still, let's not forget that we are a resilient country. And so having said that, I deeply believe, as an answer to your question, that first and foremost, with cooperation and with a universal desire for a vibrant economy, lenders and tenants, okay, I know, lenders and businesses, owners, will forge a successful and an enduring relationship. And that's my answer. Today, we need policy, but policy will not serve the community if the community is not communicating, if there isn't transparency and accountability from both sides, all right? So, yes, a lot of people, let's not forget, received money throughout the moratoria, okay? They were able to apply PPP. There were many opportunities to receive funding, okay? But they did not receive education. In other words, people received money, but they were not informed, when the moratoria finished, you still owe the rent, okay? You still owe the loans. There are fees. You are bounded by a contract. So there was a lack of communication, which drove me nuts, all right? And right. It's only through the local activities that I saw that through small workshop, through small educational programs, through Catholic charities, through Catholic university, through parishes, that people got this awareness. Oh, wait a second. This is not, oh, I don't have to be worried about it, okay? This is an opportunity for me to do what I want, and right now I'm just going to milk the cow if I can be colorful, right? This
right.
was an educational opportunity for a lot of people, and again, for the third time, transparency and accountability from top to the bottom, but also from the bottom to the top, goes both ways, at the governmental level, but also down at our level as human beings.
And I think it's a good point, because one of the arguments that emerged today, Dr. Ensler, and again, we're taking your calls at 888-914-9149 if you want to join the conversation, was that there was a lot of money that still has been left unspent, too.
Correct.
That governors have. And this was, I believe, from the third relief bill that passed in March. There was a lot of block granting for states, a lot of
Indeed.
Which has gone unspent. And there were a number of people on Capitol Hill saying, look, I mean, we may not need to extend this. We provided the states with plenty of resources. The states really should be taking charge of this and dealing with this issue more than the federal government should be. And of course, you know, that may end up being a better way of going anyway, or it may also be a way of passing the buck, let's face it.
Correct. Yeah, just passing the problem to you. Correct.
Right. But I mean, those resources have not yet been spent. And this is something that states could actively be working on to provide that off ramp to the pandemic emergency.
Correct. Listen, we are good people. And I know that throughout this time, I've seen a lot of suffering. I've seen a lot of crisis at family levels. A lot of people lost their jobs. You know, a lot of family, like an Italian way, you know, everybody lived at home and they beat the hell out of each other, okay? But now they love one another more because they finally got to talk. They lost power or they didn't have their devices working. They talked, okay? And they learned how to fix a sink that was leaking. You know what I'm saying? Conversation, yep. Unity. People in crisis, they rediscover the values of the family, of the community, the importance of relationship. And I believe now we are on the tail, okay, of this crisis. It's time to restart. The economy is restarting. If you want a job, you can get a job. Houston right now has a negative unemployment rate, okay? If you want a job, you can get three jobs if you want right now. It all boils down to common sense. It boils down, okay, now it's time to fold my sleeves back and move on. From the renter perspective as well as from the landlord perspective, all right? We need guidance, okay, but we don't need surveillance, all right? There is plenty of assets out there that are available for landlord or rents, okay? Again, transparency. Let's be crystal clear. In order to access these funds, this is what you have to qualify and so on and so far. We are the most powerful country in the world. Yes, we have 12 million people that might find themselves on the street, but I dare to say today here to our listener, there are a lot of people out there that are ready to welcome, if it's the case, these people.
You know, Dr. Mario Ensler, we got about a minute left here, and I think the one thing that that most concerns me at the tail end of all of this, all of these very large scale top down interventions, is that people. I mean, you sort of hinted at this, is that people are going to become addicted to it. And
Correct.
they're going to be expecting that. And I think that may be the most dangerous part of the very necessary interventions that took place during this pandemic, is that there is there may end up being a level of expectation that these are the things that are going to continue in perpetuity. And it's just simply not sustainable.
it's absolutely right. This is not going to, you know, set a trend, all right? We are a resilient country. We are going to come out stronger, and it's up to us to educate people that are confused deliberately or unwilling or without knowing, but it's our duty to explain and let the truth prevail.
Indeed it is. And the truth is that you can't get good gelato in the United States. That's correct. Amen. Dr. Mario Insler. Like I said, I'd love to do like a whole segment on gelato. But rather than do that, why don't you tell us where people can find any work that you're doing and
it's an honor for me to be the dean of the business school at the University of St. Thomas in Houston. We are a member of the Newman Guide. We are an authentic Catholic university with 4,000 students in downtown Houston. Not very well known, okay, because sometimes people, they have a tendency to think that Houston is hot and humid. And yes, Houston is hot and humid. But there are great people. Wonderful things are happening. If you want to know more, www.stthom.edu, and you can find everything that we are doing in this amazing university.
www.stthom.edu. That's where you can find out what's going on at the amazing University of St. Thomas in Houston. Dr. Mario Insler, thank you so much for being with us. Coming up next, the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.